This podcast is a part of Sphera,
a collective of independent media outlets from across Europe.
For more information,
visit sphera-hub.com.
Welcome back to the European Train Podcast, where one of our hosts is always on a train. Where are you now, Dominic? I lose track.
I have been going back and forth from Belgium quite a lot this week for some fun rehearsals, which is really nice. Like, it's amazing to be able to do that again, like my life used to be pre-pandemic. But I am just waiting to catch the old cron.
The old cron. Well, I'm happy that you're out and about. It's nice that you're getting out of the house.
It is. Have you not been getting out of the house?
Not really, no. I've mostly been sitting here reading up on the law. Do you remember last week when we were talking about that Italian Supreme Court case about the noisy toilet and the neighbours that like sued over this, these brothers next door who'd installed this extremely noisy toilet?
How could I forget?
And I was talking about how I had a similar gripe with my neighbour upstairs, the insomniac. Joseph has written from the United States to tell me that I might have a case in the US court.
But not in European court.
Not in a French one, no. So I'd have to sort of pick my apartment building up and move it to US soil.
And take poor Eve with you as well.
I don't think he'd like that very much. Really hope he's not listening to this. He said he might to practice his English. Anyway, what's going on this week? What have we got coming up on the show?
Well, we've got a pretty jolly interview coming up later in the show for once. We're going to be speaking to the woman dubbed probably the most colourful person in Ireland. Taryn Devere brightened up the internet for the month of January with a challenge she set herself to dress up as a different household object every day of the month. You heard that right. Taryn dressed up as an object she found in her house every day of the month. And the results have been totally glorious. We'll be speaking to Taryn later on in the show about why she set herself this wonderful task and more broadly about what it's like to break the expectations of society with the clothing we wear.
But first, who's had a good week?
It's been a good week for Sergio Mattarella, who was re-elected for another term as president of Italy.
Was it actually a good week for him?
Well, no, he didn't really want the job. Poor Sergio is 80 years old and had made repeated signals that he'd really like to retire and move on to other things. Pictures had even been posted on social media accounts of his boxes all having been packed up. And he'd apparently taken out a lease on a nice apartment in Rome that he was going to move into. But in the end, he was the only person that Italy's fractured parliament could agree on. So he is staying, albeit a bit reluctantly. Apparently, some party representatives went to his presidential palace and begged him to stay on following a week of stalemate around who would succeed him. The pleas worked and he agreed to follow Parliament's wish for him to stay on.
I can't believe he's been bullied into this. I feel so bad for him. He's 80 already and they're 7-year terms, aren't they? So he's going to be like 87 when he retires.
Yeah, if he decides to stay for the whole term, there's some suggestion that maybe someone could take over at some point, but yeah, we'll see. On the other hand, I think it's quite refreshing to have like such a reluctant president. We're so used to power-hungry people going for these top jobs, desperate to hold these levers of power. And I think it's kind of maybe a bit refreshing that for once there's a president who really doesn't want to be there.
I mean, we've seen in the UK what it's like when mad people who love power get all the important jobs. But yeah, wow, the things that some people do for their country. What kind of powers does the president actually have in Italy?
Well, it's largely a ceremonial role, but they do have some pretty key powers, such as the power to dissolve parliament and the power to choose the new prime minister. A power that he used recently, you probably remember last year when there was this political crisis in Italy and they couldn't work out how to form a government. And in the end, Mattarella appointed the current prime minister, Mario Draghi, to step in and create this government with support from across the political spectrum to respond to the dual challenges of the coronavirus pandemic and the economic crisis. And what these negotiations around who is going to be the next president have laid bare is quite how difficult it is to get this coalition of politicians from the left to the right to agree on anything. There were various ideas for who would replace Mattarella. Some thought that the most important thing was to finally have a woman in the role, but there was no one female candidate that a majority of parliamentarians managed to get behind. Mm. Italy's controversial ex-prime minister, Silvio Berlusconi, seemed to be putting himself forward for the job at some point, but that was a bit of a flop, as was the idea of current prime minister Mario Draghi stepping up to the presidential role. That was actually one that some people really thought was going to happen for a while, but there were fears that Draghi stepping into the presidential palace could have launched Italy into yet another political crisis, as the coalition would have then had to have found a new prime minister that they could all agree on, right, which would have been very difficult and could have meant early elections, which is something that many coalition partners do not want. So in the end, they ended up with President Mattarella staying in his position.
Apparently there are all these internet memes showing him as like a hostage, which isn't very funny, but it kind of is funny. God, poor guy. So what do I need to know about him as like a person? Is he controversial? What's he like?
Well... he is pretty well respected and pretty popular across Italy and has been since he took over the position in 2015. He's got a background in the Christian left, a kind of center-left Christian background. And he was a judge. He's been around forever. He's been a minister of defense. He's been a deputy prime minister. He was the minister of education. He's done it all. So I think he's like clearly the status quo option. And in this case, he was definitely the status quo option because he was already president, so it meant nothing would be changing. Another reason why many parliamentarians didn't want anyone that would maybe cause the coalition to fall and to bring an early election is because a lot of them may well lose their jobs at the next election, not just because of some potential big changes in election results compared to the last election, but also because a major constitutional reform is expected to reduce the number of MPs elected from 945 to 600. Ah. So lots of sitting MPs are going to lose their jobs at the next election.
And when is that?
Well, if the coalition manages to keep their shit together, then the election is scheduled for spring 2023. So not that far away, but Draghi has a lot of things he wants or needs to get done during that window. And this compromise over Mattarella staying on has made many analysts look a bit skeptically at his possibilities of making these things that need to get done, done before spring 2023. Italy is meant to be the biggest recipient of this huge $750 billion EU recovery fund, but the EU set some conditions to the receipt of that money, and Draghi and his government will have to pass some pretty significant reforms around public procurement and competition law if they want to receive their next chunk of that money, which I think they really do. So it's probably going to be a tricky year ahead for Draghi. That said, many in the EU are pretty relieved by Mattarella's appointment because it means that Italy can continue to be a constructive partner in the upcoming discussions about EU reforms that many hope are on the cards, at least until the next election. For the EU, there is this like rather terrifying possibility of Giorgia Meloni, the Eurosceptic populist who leads the Brothers of Italy party, gaining power at the next election. So the fact that there isn't an early election right away gives a bit of respite before what will probably be a tense election year.
And how has poor Mattarella responded to his own re-election? He must be delighted at not being allowed to retire ever.
He responded with a like somewhat emotional speech, and he said, "Duty to the nation must prevail over my own personal choices."
Richiamano al senso di responsabilità e al rispetto delle decisioni del Parlamento.
And as you said, Italian social media has been full of memes of Mattarella like tied to his chair being forced to stay in the presidential palace. But it does seem like he's taking the decision of parliament with some grace. And yeah, he may be staying at a job he doesn't want, but it means another few years living in this pretty lush presidential palace. So I don't feel too sorry for him.
Oh, I'm going to Google it now. Nice. Spacious.
Yeah, it looks like there's a lot of space. Still, no woman has ever held this role, and an 80-year-old man has been reappointed, which is not great and kind of significantly reinforces this stereotype that Italy is run by a bunch of old men.
I knew there was some way you were going to bring me down at the end of Good Week. You never fail.
Thank you. Who's had a bad week?
I'm giving bad week to the aviation sector this week. I mean, really, every week is a bad week for the aviation sector. But there was a particularly grim story that caught our eye. A report from Greenpeace, who are warning that airlines may be operating as many as 100,000 ghost flights across Europe this winter. Do you know what a ghost flight is?
I think I do. It's like an empty flight, isn't it? Not a flight for ghosts.
It's not a flight for ghosts, no. But yeah, I didn't know this was a thing until your husband told me about them recently. So the flight might not be completely empty, but there could be just like 3 passengers on board. Basically, so few passengers that it really feels like they should have just cancelled the flight because it seems so environmentally obscene in terms of like the emissions per person on board. But basically the reason this happens is that airports have to have a system for deciding which planes take off and land at which times. And in Europe and other places as well, we have a system where competing airlines hold the right to use particular takeoff and landing slots. And these slots are like really valuable as an asset. They sometimes get traded for tens of millions of euros. So if you think, for example, about a slot that would allow you to take off from Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris at like 10 a.m., that is going to be a lot more valuable than a slot that leaves at like 4 o'clock in the morning from Paris Beauvais Airport, which is really, really, really far away from actual Paris. And that is partly why budget airlines often fly from out-of-town airports and at horrible times. The older and fancier airlines like Lufthansa and Air France and like British Airways, they hold a lot of the most valuable slots. And because everyone wants to take off from big airports at nice times, the EU has created a system whereby if an airline doesn't use their slots, they lose them. That seems fair, right?
Yeah, I feel like I'm falling into a trap by saying yeah.
Not really. I think it does seem kind of fair as a principle. Like, say, for example, that you run an airline, but nobody likes you anymore because you've been involved in some scandal. I don't know. Like, it wouldn't be fair for you to hog all of these nice slots, even though you have no passengers, right? Like, another airline that does have passengers should be able to take it off you. So in Europe, the rule is normally that an airline has to run at least 80% of their scheduled flights, or they risk losing their slots to one of their competitors. Seems kind of reasonable. The problem during the pandemic has obviously been that hardly anyone was flying in Europe for a really, really long time. And that was great news for the environment, but it did raise a question with what to do about these airport slots. And at the start of the pandemic in early 2020, the European Commission just said, okay, let's just suspend this rule. No airline is going to have their slots taken away for failing to operate 80% of their scheduled flights, because obviously nobody is flying 80% of their flights.
So there was like no pressure for airlines to run all their flights just so they would hang on to these precious slots.
Right, exactly. But more recently, people have started slowly and cautiously to travel again. And so the EU thought some version of the old rules needed to come back. So back in October, the EU brought back a less strict version of the old rule. And they told the airlines, okay, you have to operate at least 50% of your scheduled flights. Not 80% like before, just 50. Otherwise, we might give your slots to one of your competitors. And that is why, since October, some airlines have been running flights with barely anyone on them. It's because this pressure to use the slots or risk losing them, that's come back.
So how bad is it? Did you say that Greenpeace thinks that there could be as many as 100,000 of these ghost flights?
Yeah, and that is a really sickening prospect. Like, it goes without saying that we should be cutting down on air transport in general. But running empty planes around? I mean, that's madness, and it's absolutely infuriating. I think it is important to mention that this 100,000 ghost flights figure from Greenpeace, they've had to make quite a few assumptions to get there, because most airlines are not being upfront about how many ghost flights they're running. In fact, it's really only Lufthansa, the German airline, that has publicly admitted that they might end up running a total of 18,000 ghost flights just to keep their slots. So Greenpeace have basically done some back of the envelope calculations based on Lufthansa's market share and estimated that this equates to as many as 100,000 pointless flights across all airlines. They said that's the equivalent of the emissions created by 1.4 million cars in a year, which is horrendous. But again, they've had to make some assumptions like, okay, let's say each flight is like 90 minutes long and is a 200-seater plane. It's not a perfect method, and not everyone agrees with how Greenpeace have calculated this. Some climate people have pointed out that empty planes actually use less fuel because they're lighter. Mm. And that is like one example of a thing that Greenpeace didn't take into account when doing their number crunching. But the thing I found really interesting isn't the exact number of depressingly pointless flights, because we do know that this is happening in general and it sucks. But the policy argument around it is actually really not as straightforward as it might look on first glance. Greenpeace have come out very heavily against the EU on this and said, isn't it disgraceful? There is an EU law that is encouraging airlines to run these pointless flights, and that is incredibly hypocritical, given everything that the EU says about wanting to be the most environmentally friendly place on Earth. And my instinct is to feel like that too, and to direct my anger over this primarily at Brussels. They've definitely taken a lot of criticism over it. Greta Thunberg, for example, tweeted an article about the ghost flights with a sarcastic comment. She wrote, "The EU surely is in climate emergency mode." And Lufthansa, the airline, they've come across as very regretful about the situation, saying, you know, we don't want to run 18,000 pointless flights. We hate polluting. If only the EU wasn't forcing us to fly all of these planes. But I do think it is worth at least considering whether it's right to lay all of the blame at the EU's door for these ghost flights. So let's consider Brussels' point of view for a second. They have said, well, no one is forcing airlines like Lufthansa to fly these pointless flights. It's the company deciding to do that. And if they don't have enough passengers to run a particular flight, they could just not run the flight.
Which kind of seems like a fair suggestion. They're saying, if your passengers haven't come back now, then you have to let go of those slots.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the EU is saying, we're not doing this arbitrarily. The air traffic data suggests that this year, Europe is going to have about 88% of the volume of flights that we had before the pandemic. So it's not that unreasonable to tell big airlines like Lufthansa, hey, like, you guys can't just hog the nice slots at the airport. Otherwise, we might give them to one of your competitors. Right now, airlines like Lufthansa are being told they have to run 50% of their scheduled flights or risk losing their slots. That is due to go up to 64% next month. Another thing that Brussels is saying is that actually the rule isn't that strict. And if, for example, there are new travel restrictions because of COVID, there will be some flexibility on having to run the flights that airlines said they were going to run. One weird upshot of the situation is that we've seen two quite unusual alliances form on either side of this argument, because you've got budget airlines like Ryanair, who really want to take some of these cushy takeoff and landing slots from the bigger airlines. And they're on Brussels' side. They're like, well, you know, if Lufthansa can't find enough passengers to go on their planes, we will find the passengers. Give us the slots. And on the other side, you've got Greenpeace and Lufthansa effectively saying the same thing, which is that this EU rule is stupid.
It is kind of weird to think of Greenpeace and Lufthansa on the same side of any argument.
It is a bit weird. And some environmental Twitter has been a bit skeptical about Greenpeace's stance on this, or just questioned it, and suggesting even that they're almost helping Lufthansa to put across this argument in public that they're being forced to operate these flights and they have no other choice. I mean, look, there definitely has been a policy failure here, but maybe, some people have suggested, it would be better to spend our energy on trying to find a better way of managing this system. One environmental researcher on Twitter suggested that airlines who do the best job at reducing their emissions, they could be rewarded with the best slots. Maybe that's one way of doing it.
Sounds like a really good idea.
But yeah, I mean, look, it is super, super depressing that planes have been flying with barely anyone on board. And that is why I'm giving bad week to the aviation industry this week. But it is, I think, a bit oversimplistic to see this EU rule as the one thing that's wrong here. I think that narrative is a little too convenient for the board members of Lufthansa.
Well, thank you for explaining that to me. I really didn't get that nuance when I just read little articles about the ghost flights. It's time for us to thank the lovely people who are supporting us on a website called Patreon, where you can go and throw some coins at us so that we can keep this podcast going.
Ow.
This week, we are especially grateful to our newest supporters, who are Fanny Bucarel, Sarah Angel, and Martin Cox and Amia Gupta, for increasing their pledges.
Thank you all so much. Just going back to trains again, there was a fun discussion about night trains on the Facebook page for our Patreon supporters this week. And one of our listeners, Paul, posted a picture of, I think, the same night train that you took. And can I just say, you protest too much. That looked like a beautiful train.
He had it for one person. I had it for three people. For one person, it would be great. It was really nice. And he's right. We did get offered a small bottle of Prosecco on arrival.
You got free booze. This is unbelievable.
But if you
I had to share my French train with two loud snoring men.
I saw the photo of your French train. It was much bigger than my couchette.
Grass is always greener, eh? Anyway, if you would like to talk about trains, Netflix recommendations and other European things, our secret Facebook group for our Patreon supporters is a really fun place to do that. And membership of this lovely group is just one of the perks of supporting this podcast, along with just knowing that you're an amazing, amazing person. One of our New Year's resolutions for 2022 is to do more resolutely cheerful interviews. And since the weather is still pretty bleak out there, in this hemisphere at least, we thought now was a great time to start. Today's guest is someone who caught Dominic's eye on Twitter. The tweet said, "Day 23 of dressing like things in my house. Today I am cheese puffs." And then the tweet had two pictures, one of them of a packet of crisps and the other of a woman dressed as the packet of crisps. She was in a metallic blue dress that looked uncannily like a shiny crisp packet. And she'd even made a kind of Walker's logo and like strapped it to her head. She looked amazing. Needless to say, our curiosity was piqued. The woman in the photos is Taryn Devere. Her Twitter bio reads, "Possibly the most colourful woman in Ireland." And it turns out that throughout January, she has been doing this every single day, dressing as household items from toothpaste to potatoes. And the pictures are just really straightforwardly joyful. We are not the only people to think that. Taryn has been in Der Spiegel. She has been on Iranian television. But she found time in her increasingly busy schedule to talk to your favourite European podcast. We gave her a call in County Donegal. Have you always been a colourful dresser?
Yeah, I would say that I have always been an out there dresser. I have sensory processing issues. When I was little, I had a very specific sense of how I experienced the world visually and also through touch. And so I was very drawn to different types of fabrics of different textures. And often those were fabrics that were silks and satins and like slips and things like that. So I would wear my grandma's slips all the time because I like the feel of it against my skin. So I think my eccentric dressing started when I was a child and has just continued through my life.
And yeah, you've been doing some particularly eccentric dressing throughout the month of January. We're speaking to you on the final day of January, where you've been doing a challenge dressing up as a different household item every single day of the month. How did you come up with this idea?
So I worked for the last 2 years straight. I was working as a social media manager and PR comms kind of work. And also I have a small sideline business selling fashion accessories that I make. So I was really busy with all of those different jobs that I was doing. And I hadn't had a break for 2 years. I didn't have a holiday, nothing. And I'd had enough money saved to take a month off. So I decided I would take January off and that I would just spend the month relaxing and being creative. And then literally at the end of December, and I was looking at the news and it was like 1 in 5 people in Ireland have coronavirus. And I thought, oh no, this is not good. I'm just going to have to stay in my house. So then I thought, well, if I have to stay in my house, why not be inspired by my house? And I set myself the challenge of dressing inspired by a different item in my house every day. And because this is a podcast, it's important that I say this isn't kind of costumes. It's not dress ups. It's creating wearable, as stylish as possible outfits that are based on the design, colors, branding, logos of different packaging of different items in my house.
My favorite so far was, I think, day 7, where you dressed as a bottle of toilet cleaner and looked magnificent. Is there one particular outfit where you've been like, yes, I have nailed it today?
Yeah, I was like really excited. The custard outfit is going to break the internet because custard, that's yes. So iconic, that outfit. I'm so proud of that. I really nailed it and it's incredible.
And could you tell us a bit about how you put these costumes together? How have you done this whilst the shops were closed?
Yeah, well, my one rule was I had to use things I already had in my house. So I haven't bought anything new for any of the outfits. It's all been things I already own. But I have been collecting vintage clothes since I was a teenager. I have a really huge collection of accessories. I have a very big dress-up box. Let's put it that way.
Aside from your household item costumes, you dress up fabulously, extravagantly, a lot of the time, it seems. And I've seen pictures of you in these all these big colourful dresses and big vibrant headpieces and accessories out in public. How do people respond to you when you're out in public? Does it ever feel a bit vulnerable going out with such a colourful outfit?
Generally, people respond with delight. There is a certain age of Irish woman who sort of hates me on sight and gives me a very angry look, like, how dare you be out in public looking like that? But that's very rare that I come upon those people, you know, but they're definitely there and I get the looks from them. But generally, people are delighted and I get people just coming up to me to talk about the clothes that I'm wearing all the time. The only time I've ever felt vulnerable was when I was very involved in fashion activism. And I created different headpieces with political messages or for specific campaigns, particularly kind of Repeal the Eighth, the abortion legislation. And then I did actually feel physically unsafe a couple of times because there's obviously like a lot of anti-choicers and some of them are violent and frightening. So there were times when I was like, kind of like, be brave, you can do this, you know, it's okay. Like, it's funny, but there's something different. People wear t-shirts with slogans, but there's something very different about like wearing almost a sign on your head that's, I don't know, it made me feel much more vulnerable.
Your daughter is trans and you've spoken very movingly about how clothing helped her to find herself. Can you tell us a bit about what that journey has been like for the two of you?
She told me that she was trans when she was 5, but she's since told me that she sort of always knew that she was a girl and that her earliest realization of that was when she was around 3, she says. So when she told me, she actually asked me if all women have vulvas. That was the question she asked. I was driving, I was distracted, and I said yes. And then straight away I said, oh no, actually some women don't have vulvas. Trans women don't have vulvas. And she said, what's a trans woman? And I explained to her what a trans woman was. And then she said, so I could be a girl. And I said, well, you know, if you feel like you were a girl and you feel like you're more of a girl than a boy and that's the sense you have about your own identity, then yeah, you know, you could. You know, I didn't really take it very seriously at the start because, you know, one of my other kids was like a dog for about a year and we'd have to like put a bowl on the floor and stuff because she would literally like hop around the house and stuff and wear the Scooby-Doo costume. And we just were like, okay, that's her. She's just pretending to be a dog. It doesn't matter to me what clothes my kids wear. They're having fun and being creative. That's fine. I didn't really take it too seriously, but she was so excited. And then she said, so can I get a dress? And I said, yeah, of course you can. If you want to have a dress, that's fine. We didn't have any dresses that would fit her in the house at the time. So I made her a dress that night and she was just so delighted. And then she asked if she could have a new name, if she could change her name to a girl's name. So there was kind of a conversation with her and her siblings where they all gave ideas and then she agreed on a name. And that was it, really. It's not an especially meaningful thing to me to have a trans child because I'm not particularly attached to my children presenting as one gender or the other. You know, what's important to me is that they have a good heart and that they're kind people in this world. But you do really care about how the world is going to respond to your child because we live in such a transphobic world. Like 99% of the negative experiences that my daughter has had have come from adults. Adults who were mocking or cruel about my daughter wearing a dress when she had short hair and they thought that she was a boy. And so that was really difficult. Like it makes you so angry because I can't get my head around why an adult would care so much about how a child they don't know dresses that they would actually wound and harm that child emotionally. Like I find that incomprehensible. That's been the difficult bit, but we haven't had that in many, many years. So thankfully that's not a problem that we have to deal with anymore.
That's good to hear. Is one of the reasons why you like dressing up so extravagantly as a way to give an example to your kids that they can be whatever they want and they can wear whatever they want?
I don't really think it's that calculated. I think it's really important to teach children to have good self-esteem and good self-confidence. I think that we role model that as much as we can as parents, and that's the best way that kids learn is when they see things role modeled. And like, my children have never heard me say a thing about my body. Never have they ever heard me say, oh, I have flabby arms or look at my belly or whatever, you know. And if my kids say something to me, like they'd be like, oh, your bum's really big, I would say, yeah, I know, isn't it beautiful? It's a great body. It's got me here, you know. Birthed five children, carries me around all the time. So it's not calculated. It's just that I would struggle to be inauthentic if I can't walk around wearing gray and black. I think I would be depressed and sad, and it wouldn't be fun for me. Life wouldn't be fun for me. I saw this clip from the BBC archives from the late 60s a few weeks ago. And it was Carnaby Street in London. It was a crowded street scene, people of all ages. And all the people were dressed in these amazing colors. There was like men in their 70s wearing orange jackets and lime green shirts. And everybody was wearing amazing colors. I just thought, when did we decide that black and brown and navy were adult colors and that that's what being an adult means? Like, we already live in a pretty cold and dark part of the world. Why did we let that become the normal and then suddenly just say, okay, color is for children? I just find that really fascinating. And I find it sad that people are so afraid to wear color as well, you know? I mean, I'm sure there's people out there who feel great wearing black and who feel great wearing gray. And I'm not saying that everybody has to be the same as me, but I do think that there are people who, I know there are, because people contact me who say they'd love to wear color, but they're too scared. And that's really sad.
As for the household objects challenge, Taryn, you were originally just going to do the challenge for January. Is that it? Are we done now?
So what happened was, in January, people started sending me photos and asking me to dress up as different things in their houses. I was like, well, you know, thanks for sending me this picture, but my challenge was to dress as things in my own house for the month of January. And then I thought, okay, in February, I'll dress as things in other people's houses because so many people are asking me to do this. So I just put out a post and I said, look, this is what I'll do in February, but I'm going to have to make money somehow. I have to pay my rent and feed my kids. So I will open myself up to brands and dress as things that brands pay me to dress, as well as things in other people's houses, so that I can continue with the daily nature of the posts. Because I think that's sort of really important to people, that every morning they wake up and they know there's going to be the picture. Seems to have become something in a lot of people's lives, and I don't want to let people down. And it's a lot of fun for me too. I already have submissions for sort of the first part of January, and I'm inviting anybody who wants to send me an item. You have to send me a picture and you have to send me the story about it. So like, why it's important to you or your family or your culture or your locality, so that I can share the story behind whatever the item is.
Do you think Taryn has the best job in the world?
Yeah, maybe she does, although I would be terrible at it. I have no sewing skills.
We've also got really bland wardrobes, as we realised.
Yeah, oh my God, I really was wearing my greyest jumper in that interview. I was so embarrassed. I mean, I was wearing a pink t-shirt underneath. I almost like ostentatiously took my jumper off to show some colour.
Anyway, you should all go follow Taryn immediately on social media, where you can catch daily installments of her joyous journey. She is on Twitter and Instagram at Taryn DeVere. What have you been watching or reading or otherwise enjoying this week?
I watched a documentary called Into Eternity. It's a film about what to do with our nuclear waste.
That sounds fun.
It is. And it's made by the Danish filmmaker Michael Madsen, but it's set in Finland, where they've been building a huge underground repository to store the country's nuclear waste since 2004. The facility should be completed in the next year or so. But the cave goes at least 4 kilometers below ground and must not be disturbed for the next 100,000 years, which is the length of time that the waste will continue to be hazardous.
Wow.
And the film asks the question, how do we ensure that future generations don't intervene and try to explore this cave? It's a pretty mind-boggling thought experiment, because We really don't know how we should expect to communicate the danger of this venue with future populations of humans or human-like creatures.
Oh, because they might not use the same like writing systems as us.
Well, exactly. There may have been mass extinctions, but some survived, or who knows? Mm. How do we stop our descendants from thinking that they've discovered something like the pyramids of Giza, or thinking that it's a depository full of treasure? So many interesting questions, a few slightly over-the-top directorial arty flourishes in the film, but nonetheless, I really recommend it. The documentary is called Into Eternity.
Nice. I do really want to check that out.
What have you been enjoying, Katie?
I also watched a really good documentary this week, this one about the Belarus protest movement. It's called Courage, and it follows three actors slash musicians from the Belarus Free Theatre in the run-up to the stolen election back in summer 2020. Man, what a film. I found it really, really powerful. I know not everyone loved it, especially Belarusians who've seen it. But as an introduction to what this time actually felt like for people living through it, for those of us who didn't experience it, I think it works really, really well. And in particular, there's some very moving moments where you see people weighing up this agonizing choice of what might be gained by either taking part in these protests or staying away from them. One of the actors, she has a kid, and you see her and her partner grappling with this. They're like, you know, we're parents. Like, what happens if one of us is imprisoned? But then they're like, well, as parents, isn't it better for our kid if he can live in a freer society? It's really, really heartbreaking to see. I thought it was a really beautiful film. It might be a bit tricky to find right now, depending on where you are. But if you are in the UK or Ireland, at least, it is available right now to rent via the Barbican website.
I'm not sure we need a happy ending this week after speaking to Taryn, but I'll give you one anyway.
Go on, treat me.
I heard this week about a cheering initiative by Berlin's public transport body, the BVG. They have been selling day tickets for public transport that are laced with hemp oil.
This is not where I thought this was going. Okay.
The tickets are made with edible paper, so once you're done with them, you can munch on your ticket and enjoy a promised calming effect from the hemp oil. Which sounds like a really good idea to me, although, as I've experienced firsthand myself, the ticket inspectors on Berlin's transport system can be quite heavy-handed, so presumably you should make sure that you don't eat it until the journey is over.
Or maybe we should be feeding them to the ticket inspectors, just so they can chill out a bit.
Not a bad idea.
You know, the new German government, isn't legalising cannabis one of the things that they've said they're going to do?
Yes, they are going to do it, and it's not happened yet, but yeah, hemp oil doesn't actually contain any THC, which is the principal psychoactive constituent of cannabis. So this is allowed. And the operator promises that the oil is completely harmless. And I think more likely than not, eating this paper will have pretty little effect. It's probably a bit of a gimmick, but it's one that tickled me anyway. And I like that it acknowledges that people can get really stressed out on public transport. So yeah, I thought it was a nice happy ending.
What a weird thing for a public authority to do. Ah, Berlin, I love you. We will be back next week for some more stories across the continent in between Dominic's train rides. In the meantime, find us on social media. We haven't yet dressed up as European household objects, but I'm not ruling it out. Twitter at EuropeansPod and Instagram at EuropeansPodcast.
We should actually do that.
What would you be?
Maybe I'd dress up as a packet of Stroopwafels.
Nice. You'd be so round and sweet.
What would you wear?
I'd probably be like an IKEA Billy bookcase or something.
Classic you.
This podcast was produced by me and Wojciech Oleksiak. Katz Laszlo is off plotting some forthcoming episodes. If you're looking for some more continental podcasts, check out some others in the Are We Europe audio family. The link is in the show notes.
We'll be back next week, next Thursday, in your feeds. Go tell everyone about us, please.
Thank you. Bye.